Our speaker this morning has already been partially introduced to you. We are glad to have him back home again. As I recall, he received the Bachelor of Science degree from this university in 1926. The next year, the Master of Science degree from Iowa State College. Then he did graduate work at the University of California. He entered the commercial field, particularly in the field of marketing. He is recognized as one of the eminent specialists in marketing in the United States, and for a number of years was the executive secretary of the National Council of Farmer Cooperatives. In a religious sense, he has been connected with Boy Scout work, has been a member of some stake presidencies, lived for some years in Washington, D.C. Then for the past few years, he has been called to be a member of the Council of the Twelve. We're very happy to have him with us again this morning, Elder Ezra Taft Benson.
I am very grateful for this inspiring rendition of one of our musical gems. I'm grateful, too, that President Jensen did such an effective job of taking care of Dean Lloyd. I thought I would have that responsibility. I can't refrain, however, from referring to one little thing in the life of Brother Lloyd when we were students together here. One of the girlfriends of the girl who later became Brother Lloyd's wife met her in the hall one day, and she said, "Lil, has your boyfriend's English improved any?" And Lil said, "No, Mary. He still ends every sentence with a proposition." But he finally got his own way. He married the girl. It's been just 52 weeks today, my brethren and sisters, since I had this opportunity of looking into your faces, one of the inspiring experiences of my life. At that time, I tried to impress upon your hearts something of your blessings. I don't suppose you remember anything that I said. I was invited back to address a group of farmers in southern Utah a short time ago after having been away a year. And in answer to the letter, I pointed out that it had only been a year since I attended their meeting, and I didn't keep any record of what I said, and I'm sure if I came back again so soon, I would repeat much of what I'd said, and suggested probably they'd better get someone else. And the good man who was president of the organization wrote back in a few days and said, "Dear Elder Benson, we have checked with a number of our members regarding your first visit, and there aren't any of them who remember a thing that you said." And so I returned. And I assume that's the case this morning, so I can feel perfectly free and not worry about repeating. But I would like to say a few words this morning, if the Lord will bless me, regarding our relationship to the world, our place in the scheme of things as a church, and as a body of young people, representing as we do probably the fourth and fifth and sixth generations of Mormons here in this dispensation. Some of the critics of the church in the early days said that Mormonism would not endure beyond the third or fourth generation. Of course, every activity of our youth today is an answer to those false charges and statements. Through the years, we've been a peculiar people. We still are in many ways. If we attempted to set down a list of our peculiarities, it would fill more than one page. One of our fine servicemen who traveled with me through the occupied areas of Europe following the war told about sitting around a fire or the coals of a dying fire far back of the lines one night during combat. He was a chaplain in the service, and with him were several other chaplains. And as they were conversing one with another, one spoke up and said, "Badger, you're a Mormon, aren't you?" He said, "Yes, I'm proud to say that I am." He said, "You know, I can't understand you Mormons. Every time two or three of you get together, you hold a meeting. And whenever a larger group than that gather, you hold a conference. Why do you hold so many meetings?" "Well, I've often heard our friends outside of the church refer to us as peculiar because we hold so many meetings. And then there's another peculiarity. It was mentioned by a non-Mormon friend of mine whom I had invited to attend one of our services, one of our sacrament meetings. And finally he went to the sacrament meeting, and a few days later I met him on the street. And he said, 'Well, I was at your service Sunday. It was really fine. I enjoyed it.' But," he said, "I wish you'd tell me why it is that you people, when your meeting closes, you don't go home." He said, "The meeting ended and the people stood up, but they didn't go anywhere." Then he said, "When they finally did move out into the foyer, it was more congested there than in the chapel, and I thought I would never get out of that building." Now that's one of our peculiarities too. We love to visit. We love to attend meetings. We love the spirit of fellowship and brotherhood, which is a part of the church. And it is very real. I know it isn't what the Lord would have it be. It isn't what it will be someday. But it's one of the distinctive things about the church. And it's very real, and I'm very grateful for it. A few months ago, while in New York City, at the direction of the First Presidency, I was trying to locate a building to serve as the headquarters for the Eastern States Mission. President Smith was anxious to have a very lovely building, one that we could feel proud of, preferably on Fifth Avenue facing Central Park. And that's just where we bought it. But as I was spending time with the real estate man and representatives of the two major banks in New York City with reference to properties, the question arose with reference to our method of paying for the building. And when I told them that we would pay cash for the building, that the church never dedicated the building until it was fully paid for, the real estate man says, "Are you serious?" I said, "Yes, that's our policy. So far as I know, we don't owe a dollar to anyone in the world." And then he pointed out a number of structures there on that lovely avenue, churches, many of which he said could be bought for 40 cents on the dollar. And some of the wealthy people were moving out of the parishes in order to get out from under the debt load. And he said again, "You're indeed a peculiar people if you never dedicate a building until it's paid for." We're peculiar, too, in the fact that probably no group of people in all the world give so much in voluntary service as do the membership of the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints. I remember some years ago, while living in the nation's capital, we had a request from the Ministerial Association of that city for a group of their ministers to come up to our Washington Chapel And as they said, learn a little more about the Mormon Church. Of course, we were happy to have them come. And we asked our stake missionaries to receive them and entertain them and explain to them something of our church program. And of course, they conducted them on a tour through the building. And that was very interesting, because some of them had never seen a dance floor before inside of the same building people worshipped in. And some of them were shocked to see a basketball floor there in the chapel building. And after they'd been shown through the building and been served light refreshments, and they'd listened to a lovely organ recital, punctuated with some lovely vocal numbers by the sisters, the group went down into the Relief Society room to sit around informally and ask questions. And I slipped in at the meeting at this point, as I noted this group of fine-looking men of the cloth on one side of the room and this group of young men, local part-time stake missionaries, on the other, asking and answering questions. And I noted, as they continued their discussion, that these men trained for the ministry kept coming back again and again to one particular question. They'd ask it in a little different way, but you could tell that the thought was the same. And what do you suppose was bothering them? They wanted to know how it was possible for the church to get so much voluntary, free service from its members. And they referred to our missionary system. They referred to our bishops who serve and preside over congregations. And one bright young man who had been in the ministry only a few years said, "Why, your bishops preside over a congregation much as we do. We spend our full time at it. And your men are expected to make a living on the side." I thought that was pretty well put, the load that some of our bishops carry. But they couldn't understand it. They couldn't understand why our men will respond to calls to go out and preside over missions without any hope of material reward, leave their professions, their business careers, leave their families in some instances, to go out and serve the church. It was a marvel to them. Our missionary program, 5,200 young men and women in the field today, all voluntary service. To me, my brethren and sisters, it's one of the many evidences of the divinity of this great latter-day work. I sat beside one of my good friends, not a member of the church, back in Omaha a year ago this month. We sat at the speaker's table in a luncheon at the annual meeting of the National Commergy Council, an organization set up to sponsor and encourage the industrial use of agricultural products. And after the program was over, as we went down off the platform, this good man turned to me and he said, "I'd like to talk with you for a while about your church." And so we had a very frank and pleasant discussion. And during the conversation, he said, "There are two phases of your program that I wish we could adopt in the church of which I'm a member and a director." And I said, "What are those?" "Well," he said, "the first one is your system of financing." I said, "You mean the old law of the tithe?" He said, "Yes, that's it. And don't you have what you call fast offerings too?" I said, "Yes, but the old law of the tithe didn't originate with our people. That's an Old Testament principle." "Yes," he said, "I know, but how do you get people to pay tithing?" He said, "We once tried it, but our people wouldn't respond." I said, "Well, we don't do a 100% job either." "Yes, but," he said, "I understand that you're out of debt, and that is your principal source of income." "What is the other phase of the program?" I asked. He said, "Your missionary system." But there again, I have the same question. How do you get people to go on missions? He said, in the parish of which I am a member, we have a fund in which we offer to pay not only the transportation to and from the field, but the keep while in the field of young men who will go out into the world as missionaries. And we have great difficulty getting any to go. And he said, I understand you have 3,000 or 4,000 out. Well, brethren and sisters, why is it that we have this voluntary response from our young men and women, and older ones as well, to go out into the world, to serve in the organizations at home? It's almost a thing unheard of to have anyone decline an invitation to serve. Well, I think the answer lies in the personal individual testimony of the divinity of this work, which the members of the church have. It's one of the great strengths of our organization. The fact that we're not dependent upon anyone for that testimony, it may come to a young man or a young woman so that he may know of himself that this work is true, that the mission of the prophet Joseph was divine, that he was in very deed a prophet of God. And if we have that knowledge, then the marvel isn't that we volunteer our services. Probably the marvel is that we don't give even more freely than we do in helping to promote this great work. Yes, those are some of our peculiarities. Our great welfare program is peculiar to this people. And as we discuss it with people outside the church, it's hard for them to believe that there is a religious organization which has as its objective taking its people off the public rolls, relief rolls, and making them self-sustaining. 3 steps. First, the individual sustains himself insofar as it's humanly possible. And if he's unable to do that, then the family responsibility. And if that isn't sufficient, then the church. A great cooperative brotherhood program to take care of our own. It's one of our peculiarities. Many of our activities in recreation are peculiar to us. I toured one of the missions in the South recently, and I found that many of the people who were investigating the church were very much surprised to think that we would dance in our churches. And yet the scriptures make frequent reference to the fact that dancing was approved of the prophets. In olden times, David danced before the Lord in the parable of the prodigal son. As his brother approached the house, the record says he heard music and dancing. And yet these things are rather peculiar to us. The matter of collections. No collections in our churches, in our services. The wide distribution of authority, the wide distribution of the priesthood to boys 12 years of age. Most of you brethren whom I face this morning are no doubt elders in the church or priests, holding the authority to act in the name of God. There isn't anything like it in the world. No paid ministry. An organization aimed to build manhood through participation and activity. It's one of our peculiarities. And if you turn to our doctrine, you'll find many, many more. Our law of health, the word of wisdom, peculiar to this people. Our doctrine of the gathering. Our doctrine regarding Zion. America as the land of Zion. the return of the Jews to Jerusalem. Our doctrine with reference to temple work, vicarious work for the dead, and temple work for the living. Our belief with reference to the eternity of the marriage covenant, the family unit continuing beyond the grave. Our doctrine with reference to infants, various degrees of glory, the Book of Mormon, continuous revelation, and numerous other things that are peculiar to this people. And because of these peculiarities, in part, at least, the Latter-day Saints, from the very inception of this work, have been subject to very bitter opposition and persecution. Yes, it has resulted in almost unbounded publicity for the church, and I can't help but feel that probably the Lord had a hand in it for that reason. But there has been much opposition and persecution. I was down in the Central Atlantic States Mission recently, touring that mission with Brother Price. We held a meeting at Harker's Island in North Carolina. In order to get all the meetings in, we met in the middle of the day, 1 o'clock. They just recently outgrown their chapel and had built on a large addition. We had a fine congregation, and after the meeting, two elderly members of the branch came up and said, "It's been a glorious day. We're thrilled with the growth that's taking place." And they told me how many had been baptized in the last year and the large proportion of the congregation who were non-members of the church. But one of the good ladies spoke up and said, "But it hasn't always been this way." She said, "We've seen the smoke rise here." I said, "What do you mean you've seen the smoke rise?" She said, "We've seen our churches set afire by mobs. We've seen the homes of members burned in this area when we were girls." And then she referred to the opposition in other parts of the South. And I stood on the spot not so long ago near Atlanta, Georgia, where Elder Standing was shot down by a mob. I was in Tennessee, where two of our missionaries were murdered in cold blood by a mob, enemies to the church. Last summer, with President Morris, I was at Susquehanna in Pennsylvania, and we visited with a newspaper publisher there who has become more or less of a self-styled Mormon historian. He's an elderly man. And he pointed out the little cemetery near Susquehanna where the Prophet Joseph's oldest son was buried as an infant. He said, "I've found on good authority that during those days of bitter opposition, when the Prophet Joseph and his wife had a little home there near the cemetery, that the opposition was so great that a mob at night went into the cemetery and attempted to change the birth date of the son on the tombstone in order to make it appear as though the child had been born out of wedlock, or at least conceived out of wedlock." And then this man said, "It's almost impossible for us to understand today the bitterness of the opposition that was waged against your people in the early days of the church." I read this last week, part at least, of the hearings on the Reed Smoot case. After Senator Smoot had been elected by the sovereign people of the sovereign state of Utah, and efforts were made by people from within the state, joined by many outside, to prevent him from taking his seat in the United States Senate. More than 3,000 pages of testimony in that hearing most of it in opposition to the church and its people. It became not a hearing for Senator Smoot, but you might say that the church itself was on trial. The president of the church called back as one of the witnesses. I remember many times walking through the rotunda of the Capitol in Washington, through what is referred to as the Hall of Fame, and noting there the likeness of various chosen sons, favored sons from the various states of the Union, but no one from Utah. And I used to wonder about it. And I remember one day talking to one of the senators, I think it was Senator Ashurst from Arizona, and asking him why Utah wasn't represented there in the nation's capital. Well, he said, "Surely you know." I said, "Yes, I think I do." He said, "Your state nominated a favored son at one time in the only logical person to be so selected, and that was President Brigham Young. But it was during the days when the opposition against your people was rather bitter, and so you were unsuccessful in having him placed here." Well, I mention these things, my brothers and sisters, this morning to indicate something of what it has cost, something of what it has taken in effort, in sacrifice, in order to establish this work. I'm grateful that times have changed very materially now. President Young, the likeness of President Young, is going to be back in the nation's capital, as it should be. The many other changes are taking place in the attitude of the world toward the Latter-day Saints. And it presents to us, as young people, unusual opportunities. This thing called Mormonism, to use the words of the Apostle Paul, has not been done in a corner. You'll remember when Paul stood before King Agrippa and made his defense before the king, referring to the Christian church. He said to the king, "This thing has not been done in a corner." And that's been true of the church in this day. It has been well publicized. It has been persecuted. It has been spoken against. People almost everywhere have learned something about the church. Two years ago this January, I attended a meeting in Kansas City, held in the Civic Auditorium, called by representatives of farm organizations in the 12 Midwestern states. I should judge there were several thousand in attendance. And the man who was conducting the meeting, as it came my time to appear on the program, referred to the history of our people. He said, "As you probably know, the Mormon people have just concluded 1 year of celebration, honoring the entrance of the Mormon pioneers into the Salt Lake Valley 100 years ago. And it's just over 100 years since those pioneers were driven from almost this very area where we meet tonight." And he said, "You've heard the story of their trek across the plains. You've heard of the persecutions in Nauvoo, as well as here in Jackson County." Then he said, paid high tribute to the church, and then says, "We've invited one of the representatives of the church to come here tonight and talk to us." And as I contemplated the change that had taken place in that 100 years. As he said, we're going to give him a free hand to say anything he wishes regarding his people, their belief, their ideals, their organization, their trek across the plains. The next day, a member of the mission presidency invited me to go up to the little town of Liberty, Missouri, and inspect the old Liberty Jail, where the Prophet Joseph and his associates were incarcerated for a long period during those dark days in Missouri. As I returned from that visit, I opened the Doctrine and Covenants as I opened it this morning to that section having to do with the prayer and the prophecies which were uttered and received there as the prophet lay in that jail. I presume probably not at any other time in his life did the prophet Joseph come nearer to being discouraged than at that time in Liberty Jail. And finally, in the anguish of his soul, he cried out to the Lord in these words, O God, where art thou? And where is the pavilion that covereth thy hiding place? How long shall thy hand be stayed? Thine eye, yea, thy pure eye, behold from the eternal heavens the wrongs of thy people and of thy servants, and thine ear be penetrated with their cries. Yea, O Lord, how long shall they suffer these wrongs and unlawful oppressions before thine heart shall be softened toward them and thy bowels be moved with compassion toward them? Remember thy suffering saints, O our God, and thy servants will rejoice in thy name forever. And then came the answer from the Lord. My son, peace be unto thy soul. Thine adversity and thine affliction shall be but a small moment. And then if thou endure it well, God shall exalt thee on high. Thou shalt triumph over all thy foes. Thy friends do stand by thee, and they shall hail thee again with warm hearts and friendly hands. And then this mild chastisement. Thou art not yet as Job. Thy friends do not contend against thee, neither charge thee with transgression as they did Job. And they who do charge thee with transgression, their hope shall be blasted, and their prospect shall melt away, as the hoar frost melteth before the burning rays of the rising sun. I observe, my brethren and sisters, that in reading the Revelations, that even during the dark days of persecution, the Lord was continually pointing to the eventual outcome of this great latter-day work. In the 115th section, wherein he gives the name for the church, he encourages the saints to arise and shine, that they may be a light unto the world. And even in Revelations earlier than that, he was continually pointing out that this work would endure, that in spite of all the opposition, it would rise above its enemies and eventually go on to its great destiny. And so we've had these periods of persecution and opposition, but that time has passed, at least temporarily. For the first time in our history, it seems that we're coming to be known for what we are and not for what our enemies have said about us in the past. I was up in Anchorage, Alaska, just at the close of the war, and we held a meeting with our servicemen out at the little army chapel. And I noted as we conducted the services, many of our young men, servicemen, took part, bore their testimonies, offered the prayers, led the singing, administered the sacred emblems. Back in the corner of the chapel sat a Protestant chaplain, appearing to be working, but I could tell was listening into the service. And after the meeting was over, as we were leaving the building, I went over to this fine man to thank him for the use of the facilities. During our brief conversation, he said, "Mr. Benson, before you leave, there's something I want to say to you." He said, "I've been watching your Mormon boys in action here now for a number of months. And," he said, "I wonder if you realize the type of young manhood you have represented in these Mormon servicemen." And then he said, "I've got two sons of my own, 13 and 15 years of age. And," he said, "I could ask nothing better for them than that when they grow to maturity, they become members of the Mormon Church and develop into the kind of young manhood I've seen represented in your boys here in the service." That's a high tribute. But it's not uncommon these days, my brethren and sisters, as the world are coming to realize something of the fruits of our program. I remember many years ago, while a student here, reading something in a little book written by Thomas Nixon Carver of Harvard University. If I recall correctly, the little book was entitled something about the best religion. And he gave this test. He said, "That religion which acts most powerfully as a spur to energy and directs that energy most productively is the best religion. By their fruits ye shall know them." And we're coming to be judged, my brethren and sisters, by our fruits. And the eyes of the world are upon us today, I think, in a way that they have never been before. Friendly eyes. Many of them with a desire to learn more of our program and our doctrines and our organization. The reports that come from our mission presidents and our missionaries throughout the world indicate that never was the opportunity more favorable to promote the program of the church and to preach the gospel than it is today. And I'm grateful for that change that has come. And it presents a great challenge to us, my brethren and sisters, as young people, to live the gospel, to maintain every standard of the church, to do all in our power to build up Zion and establish the kingdom of God here in the earth. This is not just another church, not just another sect. This is the church and kingdom of God reestablished again in the earth. For the last time, our message is a world message. The Lord has made it very clear in the first section of the Doctrine and Covenants that this is His church and that the message which the church bears to the world is a message for all mankind, all God's children. And to paraphrase His own words to the prophet Joseph, "It is the only church upon the face of the whole earth with which I, the Lord, am well pleased." So spake the Lord to the prophet in that first section of the Doctrine and Covenants. And so our message is a world message, a message for the benefit and blessing of all mankind. That glorious first vision is a reality. God the Father and the Son did appear to the boy prophet, the greatest event that has transpired in this earth since the Master was resurrected. And that message is for all God's children. It's our responsibility to bear it to the world. May God bless you, my young brethren and sisters, as you strive for knowledge, that you may ever keep in your hearts burning brightly the testimony of the divinity of this great latter-day work. And may you ever have a desire to do all in your power to help to promote and spread this glorious word to the children of man and to build up the kingdom here in the earth, I humbly pray in the name of Jesus Christ. Amen.